as if sliding a letter into an envelope.
"Your husband," he said. "He's the plumber, right?"
She cocked an eyebrow.
"I've seen his truck," he added.
"You've seen it at the library?"
"Just around the neighborhood. He works a lot."
"He's never home," Dottie said, "but at least he takes Carol on the job with him sometimes. If she had her way, she'd drop out of fourth grade and take over the family business." Tomas smirked. He couldn't tell if Dottie was staring deep into his eyes or studying the flecked lenses of his horn rims. Either way, he was nervous.
"At least there's good money in being a plumber," he said.
"Not good enough."
Tomas laughed a little and chomped his gum. Before he went inside to find his little girl, he turned and watched in awe as Dottie pressed the tip of her tongue delicately into her lip. Chapter 7. In her kitchen, Lydia nibbled the crust from her honey toast and waited impatiently for her overworked coffee maker to finish gurgling. When she looked up, David was there in his towel, red from his shower, smelling of menthol shaving cream. He peered into Joey's milk crate, which sat in the center of their breakfast table where Lydia had left it the night before.
"More books?"
he said, picking up Joey's dusty Victorian story primer and turning it over in his hands.
"Can't ever have too many," she said lightly.
"Seriously, I like your whole book thing. Just having them around makes me feel smarter."
"Now if we could just get you to read them."
"No need. It's like free IQ points in every room, on every conceivable surface."
"Glad to help."
"Some would call you a hoarder," he said. "But not me. I call you a collector."
"That's the spirit," she said.
Lydia looked up the length of David's arm and saw his clean, damp hair and the remnant glow of his shower, and felt the desire to rest her hand on his.
"They're from Joey," she said, nodding at the crate on the table. "The books."
The coffee maker wheezed and David poured her a cup. She hummed self-consciously, feeling grateful as she sipped. David tilted up the lip of the milk crate and peered at the tumbled titles inside.
"Joey the Book Frog," he said, and sat in the chair next to her.
"The one and only."
"And his buddy hasn't shown up yet."
"Lyle? Not yet."
"Fishy?"
"Fishy," she said, then patted the edge of the crate. "Then there's this, gathered from his apartment, my inheritance, apparently."
"His last good deed," David said, nodding. "It's kind of sweet. He obviously knew you'd appreciate them."
"That's one way to look at it," she said.
"I'm guessing his apartment wasn't paradise?"
"More like the inferno.
Listen, I know you need to go, but..." She told him about visiting Joey's apartment the night before, and about the books he'd left to her in death, and the strange fact that the books had holes cut out of them.
"Holes?" he said.
"Little windows," she said.
"Why would he do that?" he said,
in that same cerebral tone he used when describing the way he'd cracked a coding problem at work, or figured out which sensor in his car was causing his engine to misfire.
"I mean, what's the point of giving them to you if they're all cut up?"
"That would be the question."
"Unless there's something to them," he said,
and drummed his fingers on Joey's copy of The Turn of the Screw.
"Because, with words cut out, it sounds like ransom notes."
"It's not words cut out exactly," she said. "Just little random rectangles. They intersect the letters, so no chance of mining them for, say, a ransom note or suicide note or..."
"Or a Valentine?"
"It wasn't like that," she said, unsure if this was jealousy or a joke.
"But you're sure the holes are random?" he said. "Maybe there's a pattern somehow, an encryption."
As David spoke,
His voice was fading, and she could sense him slipping away, quietly scrolling through his mental records of the Enigma device and fortune punch cards and player piano rolls and all things encoded. "Have a look," she said, then handed him the cut-up copy of A Universal History of the Destruction of Books.
"Whoa."
"I know."
"Are there others?"
"Cut up?" She rested her hand on the crate. "All of them."
"All of them?" he said.
"Some more than others, but yeah, all of them have holes cut out. Rectangles." David slid the chair back, stepped to the sink, drank a glass of water, and sat back down. Apparently now he was ready.
"This is wild," he said,
and then right to the point.
"So why leave it all to you?"
"Exactly. Maybe for some kind of message, I don't know." David leaned into the crate and shifted around some of the titles. "Look at this one," she said, and handed him the self-published spiral-bound book called The Birds and the Beakers. Unlike all the others in the crate, this book was completely peppered with the cutout windows, so it seemed as if its pages might simply disintegrate. In its own way, this defacement made it beautiful, like a bound pile of paper snowflakes. This one is definitely the anomaly. Way too many holes to follow any kind of order.
"It looks so sloppy compared to the others," he said,
and after spending a few minutes skimming its holes, he set it in an empty spot on the table and rested his hand atop it for a moment, as if processing by osmosis.
"I have no idea what to make of that one. As for these..."
He stirred through the crate, gently pushing the books around as if they were puppies in a whelping box. Occasionally, he'd lift one out and open its pages and trace his fingers over its cut-out holes, and she realized he was seeking a pattern, as if it were a stack of data cards and not a book.
"I should call in sick," he said. "This is way better than work."
She knew that if she asked him to, David would gladly bail on work, buckle into the chair next to her, and begin to sort through these piles. In a way, it would be his idea of the perfect date. He'd have a yellow legal pad and a mechanical pencil and a lifetime of puzzles from which to draw his inspiration. David spent a few minutes sorting through the titles, examining the books from all angles objectively, as if he were studying an omelet pan or a bike crank. The spine, the cover, the little Bright Ideas label stuck to the back, all of it was worthy of David's investigation. At one point, he looked up from the task and seemed surprised that Lydia was still there.
"Are these all from the bookstore?"
"Most are," she said. "All of the new ones I'm pretty sure he bought from me while I was working the register." From the crate, Lydia lifted a few books with yellowed pages and scuffed outdated covers. The Osmond Family Story, The Victorian Child's Primer, a collection of pastel poetry. "These are from thrift stores or yard sales or second-hand shops. Definitely used, anyway. Not from the store. We only sell new books." David picked those up next, turned them in his hands.
"If these are used," he said, "why do they have Bright Ideas labels on them?"
"They don't."
"They do."
"They shouldn't."
"They do," he said, turning them over one by one. "All of them do."
"Let me see," she said, skeptical. One title at a time, Lydia flipped over the books and saw that David was right. Not only did the lower corner of each back cover have a Bright Ideas label, but as she looked close enough to read the labels, the title, barcode, ISBN, shelving section, date of arrival, and price, she could see that the information crunched there in tiny type belonged to different books altogether. Lydia grunted and held her forehead.
"What is it?" David said.
"The labels are all wrong," she said. She lifted the copy of A Universal History of the Destruction of Books and tapped the label on the back. "The Bedwetter's Almanac. This should be stuck on a different book altogether," she said.
"On all of them?"
"On all of them. The new and the old, all have been mislabeled." Lydia closed her eyes. It was entirely possible, she thought, that one of Joey's books could have been tagged with the wrong Bright Ideas label, She and her comrades were, after all, overworked and underpaid, but it was entirely impossible that all of them had been mislabeled. And swapping labels from book to book made no sense, unless Joey had been up to something really stupid, like exchanging labels in order to pay less at the register, the way teenagers sometimes traded price tags on clothes in department store dressing rooms in order to buy a prom dress for the cost of a thong. But more telling than any such speculations was the fact that she was the one who'd sold Joey most of these books, so she knew they hadn't been mislabeled when he'd brought them to her at the counter. Zapping them into the inventory system, she would have noticed that the book on the screen didn't match the book in her hand, which meant that something more than stupidity was happening here.
"You wanted to know what Joey was up to with the cut-up books?" David said. "There's your answer."
"What do you mean?" Lydia said. David tapped one of the mismatched labels.
"That's not an accident. He's pointing you to this book, too. Joey is."
"Why would he do that?"
"No idea," David said with a shrug. "But if an answer exists, it's probably in the other book."
"So what? Follow the label?"
"Follow the label. Find the book it belongs to."
He looked up at the clock.
"Do you want me to stay? I would love to stay. Tell me to stay."
"You need to go."
"Shit," he said, smiling. "I know."
He rushed into the bedroom to finish getting ready, then returned to the table and kissed her. As he gathered his laptop and his jacket and started to leave the apartment, David swirled his bad hand in the direction of the milk crate, as if casting a spell on Joey's books.
"This is really messed up that he did this to you. I mean, it's cool, but..."
"Devious," she said. "I know."
"Maybe try not to, you know, get messed up from it."
"Too late," she said, and though she smiled as if she were just joking, once the door closed behind him and David's absence transformed into silence, the book-lined world of her apartment began to constrict, and Lydia utterly disappeared into Joey's messed-up crate. Chapter 8 Tomas was checking out a pile of picture books to a young mother with a tot climbing up her shoulder when the phone rang at the circulation desk and startled him. He stamped an inky due date on his thumbnail.
"Crap. Sorry."
It was a city administrator on the phone, calling about Winterfest, an annual celebration that had started this morning in the ski town of Breckenridge. At this very moment, Tomas was informed, he was scheduled to be there, parked on Main Street in his branch's rainbow-painted bookmobile, serving cocoa and handing out library bookmarks on behalf of the Denver Public Library System. The trip had been arranged months ago by the PR people downtown as a sort of goodwill gesture to encourage literacy in the state, and to strengthen relationships with small-town libraries, and Tomas had been reminded about it so often that he'd written it in bold red letters on his desk calendar, in his pocket calendar, and even on the construction paper calendar that Lydia had made him for Christmas and taped to their fridge at home. Yet he'd still managed to forget. Because that's how this week was going.
"I somehow forgot," he said on the phone. "You're paid to somehow remember."
Thankfully, the administrator explained, thick with sarcasm, Winterfest would be happening all weekend, and seeing as the town was at least a 2-hour drive into the mountains, and seeing as snow was presently tumbling over Denver, and seeing as it was getting darker every minute, he didn't exactly see how Tomas was going to solve this problem, except by putting chains on the bookmobile's tires and driving it there tonight. Yes, tonight. Yes, in the snow. If he was lucky, the librarian in Breckenridge would take the keys and let him go home, and if he was really lucky, someone from the festival would give him a lift back to the city. If not, he'd have to try to find a hotel or catch one of the moonlight buses that shuttled skiers in and out of downtown on his dime.
"You really want me to drive it there tonight?" "Only if you want to keep your job," he said. "Get going."
Tomas looked out the window at the headlights and taillights seeping over the streets, and his heart felt hollow. The snow that had begun to fall was getting thicker by the minute, whitening sidewalks and weighing down trees, and giving the gray light of dusk an atomic glow. He dreaded the long drive that waited for him out there, but an even deeper dread surrounded the news he'd soon have to break to Lydia. There would be no sleepover tonight. For the past week, tonight's sleepover had been Lydia and Carol's main topic of conversation, and they'd composed countless colorful lists of everything they wanted to do. Make candles out of melted crayons and tuna cans, pop a pot of marshmallow popcorn, tell ghost stories with flashlights after dark, but now they were going to be shattered. Carol couldn't spend the night at Lydia's after all. Not if he had to haul the bookmobile into a snowy pocket of the Rockies. Just when Tomas thought he couldn't imagine a worse afternoon, he looked out the frosty library window and saw Bart O'Toole's yellow pickup truck, with its cage of racks bouncing into the parking lot, sliding to a halt at just the right spot to block the book drop. Tomas's heart began to pound. He looked around the library and saw empty chairs and empty nooks. Almost all of the patrons had gone home, attempting to beat the snowstorm. And then he found himself staring at his watch. 4:17, it blinked. 4:17, as if to secure the moment in time, like a doctor noting a patient's expiration. O'Toole hopped up the library steps two at a time, looking swift and unshaven, and burlier than Tomas remembered. He shoved the door too hard when he came inside, so now it was propped open and cold air swooshed through the library, flapping newspaper pages and kicking the heater into overdrive. Tomas flinched.
"Hey there, pal," O'Toole said.
Tomas jogged around the circulation desk and offered a blundering hello, but before he could think of anything more to say, the girls arrived from the library basement, giggling and excited, wearing blue jeans and striped sweaters and necklaces they'd made from pop-tops. They blasted right past him and latched onto O'Toole's pant legs as he entered the book-lined foyer.
"You'll never guess what," Carol blurted to her dad, as if she'd been waiting hours to share. "A boy was bawling at school today. Just blubbering."
O'Toole played along, slapping his hands on his knees, stooping down, pretending to be dramatically interested in Carol's classroom gossip.
"It's because he was dying to come to my sleepover," Lydia said.
"Who could blame him?" Carol said, rolling her eyes like a diva. "I'd cry, too."
The girls giggled, and Tomas, aware that they were probably talking about Raj, scratched his neck uncomfortably. He'd rarely seen this side of Lydia before, taking such cruel pleasure from excluding her friend, but rather than intervene, he stayed focused on O'Toole, attempting to determine the nature of his visit. O'Toole just wiped his boots on the mat, brushed snow off his shoulders, lifted and resettled his blue jean cap.
"You're really in here all day long?" he said to Tomas. "I'd be crawling out of my skin."
"I keep busy," Tomas said. "Good to meet you, by the way."
Their hands pumped, and Tomas thought that O'Toole's grip was both strong and mild, exactly like the man. With his other hand, O'Toole held up a pink duffel bag.
"I brought Carol's stuff for the sleepover."
Carol snatched the bag, and with Lydia crouched alongside, unzipped it and began rifling through. Pajamas fell out, and a cassette tape covered with heart stickers, and a bag of rubber bands.
"Buddy, you okay?"
O'Toole said, leaning forward with a smile and intercepting Tomas's sight.
"You look like someone shat on your toast."
"Sorry," Tomas said. "It's just I had something come up for tonight. Work stuff."
"Work stuff tonight? What are you, a plumber too?"
Tomas wiped his palms on his slacks and explained his bookmobile predicament. He needed to leave soon for Breckenridge, and didn't expect to be back before midnight, maybe even later with the snowstorm.
"Bottom line," Tomas said, "no sleepover. We'll have to do it another time. I'm really sorry, girls. I know you've been..."
The girls sprang from the floor and began to beseech.
"This is not happening."
"You promised."
"Hey," O'Toole said, "I'll take them over at our place."
"That's okay," Tomas said.
"Really? Dottie and I aren't doing anything. You go do your job in the mountains and Lydia will stay the night with us. We'll make popcorn and cocoa,
Then tomorrow morning I'll bring them around here. What time's good?
Lydia had never spent the night away from home, and the thought of her first time being under Carol's roof felt too much like turning over the reins to forces he couldn't control.
I don't think so, Tomas said, looking at his watch as if his reasons were trapped behind its scratchy face.
It's up to you, O'Toole said, but just know it's no big deal for Dottie and me. I'm sure Carol's got some extra PJs and a toothbrush she can borrow.
Ew, the girls chimed.
Tomas tried to come up with a meaningful response, but even to himself he sounded like an uptight weenie, especially with the girls rolling their eyes and O'Toole shushing them for their disrespect. And so, with the smell of snow in the air and headlights beginning to pierce the gloom outside, Tomas conceded. Lydia could spend the night at Carol's.
Come around in the morning and you can help me with story time. Deal?
Deal.
Lydia barely even hugged him before following Carol and Mr. O'Toole out the library doors. Tomas stood at the window and watched the girls running across the snowy parking lot and through the pluming exhaust of O'Toole's yellow truck. As their taillights disappeared into the rising dusk, he thought of Dottie tucking in his daughter on this cold night, kissing her on the forehead, and with an empty heart, he went in search of the bookmobile's keys, with no idea of the darkness the night would bring. That evening at dinner, Lydia could not stop staring at Carol's family. While Mrs. O'Toole scooped out plates of macaroni and hot dog casserole, Mr. O'Toole gave the two girls their first sip of beer, straight from his Coors can at the table, and let them eat cold marshmallows with their dinner. Mrs. O'Toole teased him about leaving his plumbing tools all over the house, so he made a big show of dragging his toolbox off the kitchen counter and putting it on the small back porch, and when he came in, he sprinkled fresh snow on the girls' heads and laughed like a goof. For all the uneasiness Lydia felt sitting at their table, Mr. O'Toole releasing little beer burps, then winking at Lydia and Carol, Mrs. O'Toole folding and unfolding her napkin, she recognized a certain fullness in their home, in their balance as a family. Mrs. O'Toole was especially mesmerizing. Throughout the whole dinner, as Carol yammered on about their night's plans, Lydia couldn't keep her eyes off Dottie. The swirling orange shine of her hair, the slight chip in her front tooth, the rings she kept twisting on her fingers, maybe because it was impossible to avoid imagining what she would be like as a mom. All throughout Carol's house, Lydia noticed details that were different from her own, like the glittery pinecone candle holder on the shelf, and the way their orange tablecloth matched the orange flowers in the wallpaper, and the orange swirls in the countertops, and even the orange yarn of the god's eye on the wall. A mother's touch. The night evolved into dirty dishes and television and ice cream, and as bedtime approached, the heavy snow that had been dropping on Denver showed no signs of letting up. Lydia forgot about Mr. and Mrs. O'Toole altogether as she and Carol shoved aside the coffee table and other furniture and set up a fort of blankets and cushions around the couch, smack dab in the center of the living room. When it got late, they rolled out their sleeping bags inside the fort and fluffed up their pillows. With flashlights in hand, they listened to Carol's parents murmuring in their bedroom down the hall and falling gradually to sleep. They listened to the snow and wind swelling against the front door and living room windows. Then the girls listened to each other. Inside their warm fort, they giggled about the time Lydia had seen Raj's wiener falling out of his soccer shorts, looking like a plucked brown duckling. And they read for a while from Carol's book of scary stories, and soon they decided it was time to tell their own stories about magic bathtubs and a drain that sucked children through its silver pipes and led them to a world of silver manholes and silver clouds and silver homes. But their stories were interrupted when the back door swung open and banged hard into the kitchen wall. Back doors always banged like that, except it was after midnight, and the door crashed with enough force to strum their ribs a room away. Both girls froze. Lydia wondered if this was some kind of a mean trick Mr. O'Toole was playing, but she could still hear his droning snores at the end of the hallway, so she knew it wasn't him. Inside the fort, Carol grabbed the flashlights and clicked them off. "Shh," she quickly hissed. Lydia and Carol froze beneath the sagging blankets as someone unknown closed the back door and walked through the kitchen into the living room. Mrs. O'Toole had left the hallway light on so that Lydia could find the bathroom if she needed it, but the man out there slapped at the switch, turning off the only light. The darkness that followed was immense, but Lydia still had seen through the slit in the fort. A white latex glove, tight around a hairy man hand. In the glove, a hammer. The man out there was gripping a hammer, but Lydia didn't fully register this until later, when the negative space that the hammer had occupied was filled in by her memory. A wood-handled hammer, claw and head painted industrial black. It fit his perfect grip. The rest of it happened slowly. The hammer man stepped into the hallway and toward Mr. and Mrs. O'Toole's bedroom. Inside the fort, Carol gripped Lydia's wrist tightly for what seemed like hours, then abruptly let go. By the time Lydia reached out to hug her, nothing was there but a fluttering blanket. From her spot she couldn't see a thing, but her ears splashed sights through her mind. She could hear Carol's knees scrabbling over the carpet and into the hallway, and she could hear Carol screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!" The hammer man spun around and his back collided with the wall, as if he'd momentarily lost his balance. Glass popped, and a framed family portrait slid down and shattered on the carpet. For the briefest moment, the house went silent, until Carol screamed again, and in between, she seemed to be struggling for air, pivoting in the hallway, scampering to get away. The hammer man quickly found his footing, and the sounds that followed would follow forever. The man's thick boots trailing Carol, and Carol's screams, and Carol's screams extinguished. An egg dropped. Another egg dropped. Another. Almost immediately, the O'Toole's bedroom door creaked open, and Lydia could hear Mr. O'Toole grunting with confusion, and then she could hear someone's back crashing full force into the dresser, the door jamb. She could hear knick-knacks knocked from a shelf and drywall caving in, and she could hear man screams as the eggs began to drop, one at a time, all upon the bedroom carpet. With the blanket fort limp against her shoulder, Lydia could hear whimpering in the darkness. She thought it was just herself making the noise, until she realized that her cries had been joined by other cries down the hall. Mrs. O'Toole, whimpering, then pleading, then shrieking. Lydia heard the box spring squeak as someone lunged over the mattress. She heard the mattress sigh, and then she heard eggs dropping all over in there. In that moment, something rare happened inside Lydia. She stopped herself from knowing. She made a choice not to know, and by doing so she was allowed to unfreeze. Nothing was happening down the hall. Nothing was happening, so why not slip out from under this blanket and make her way over the carpet to the kitchen, through the kitchen to the back door, out the back door, and into the snowy night. She found her hands and knees, and the blanket sagged over her back, and then was gone. As she crawled full speed ahead, she looked through the darkness at the orange glow of snow in the back door window. She swished across the living room, burning her knees on the carpet, and she moved faster now, gaining speed with each slide. And then her forehead thudded straight into the corner of the coffee table, and the darkness sparkled with pain. Her face grew wet with blood that dripped into her mouth, but she kept crawling. Her eyes were wet. Her nose and lips and chin were wet. The carpet dropped into the kitchen's cold linoleum, and a cereal flake crunched beneath her palm, and then her other palm squished a puddle of melting snow tracked in on the hammer man's boots. The back door was only a few feet away, and the snow out there seemed to uplift through a trance of streetlight, but she heard the hammer man's heavy footsteps coming closer, closer, and before she gave it a thought, she was cutting a sharp left and holding a cabinet handle in her fingers, and then she was underneath the kitchen sink, squeezing next to buckets and cleaning products and pulling the cabinet door closed and pressing her cheek into the cold silver pipes. Silence beneath the sink. Nothing was happening out there, but he had to have seen her. He had to have heard her. She didn't move. She didn't breathe. And in her silence, she thought she heard spilling. A gallon of milk tilted on the hallway carpet, glug, 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 mixing with broken eggs like a recipe for her dad's birthday cake. Minutes passed, and the darkness grew wet and heavy on her face. She found a withered sponge beneath her feet, so she pressed it against her forehead and it stuck to her skin. She squeezed her knees and rested her elbow on a bucket rim. One of her socks, thick and pink, was missing,
on the living room floor, inside the blanket fort, just outside this cabinet door. Maybe she would never know. She heard the approach of bootsteps, then a smudge of brightness lit the slit between the cabinet doors, a flashlight, its faint orb erasing the world around it. As he approached the sink, his bootsteps stopped, and his shadow darkened everything. She could hear him breathing, and her muscles tightened, and the garbage disposal felt like a rock propped atop her shoulder. Inches away, she could sense the pressure of his knees against the cabinet door. Ka-tick. But the door didn't open. It didn't open. Instead, the hammerman dropped his hammer into the sink, and Lydia heard it perfectly next to her ear, steel striking steel. He dropped the flashlight and turned on the water, scalding hot, and she felt the drainage pipe warm against her cheek. Even when it began to burn, she didn't pull away. A wave of mildew tickled her nose. The hammerman rinsed his hands and swiped his fingers through the splash, a drumming fingertip sound, as if he were pressing spaghetti through the garbage disposal's black baffle. Then he turned on the disposal, and its rage of blades chattered Lydia's teeth. This moment, this gurgle of blood and hair and splintered bone whirring inside her mind, this was the only moment in Lydia's life. This was, some would say, her defining moment. That night, Denver glowed with snow. Plows went out. People slept in. And late in the morning, Tomas had a defining moment all his own, one that came after Lydia and Carol didn't show up at the library to help him with Saturday morning story time. As planned. He read Where the Wild Things Are to a few toddlers chewing mittens, and once they bundled up and left, he phoned the O'Tooles. No answer. On the radio yesterday, Tomas had heard that the state should brace for another stock show snowstorm, the annual January cold snap that coincided with the country's largest livestock fair, but he hadn't expected it to blow like this. This was something else. Finally, the snowfall was slowing, but the wind was icy and relentless, carving drifts in the barren white. No cars were out. No one was in the library but him. The morning was empty and frozen, and Tomas was exhausted. Lately, he'd been just beside himself, and last night's lonely excursion to the mountains had made it all the worse. He'd taken the last ski bus out of Breckenridge and didn't get dropped off downtown until almost midnight, and then with the storm, it took him forever to find a cab home. Now he was on his third cup of coffee and still could barely keep his eyes open. Again, he stared out the window. The snow out there, a good 14 inches of shifting drifts, was deeper than he'd realized. Deep enough to call it quits. With a feeling of gratitude, he hung a sign on the door and locked the library and walked over to the O'Toole's home, 10 blocks that felt like 20 as his feet struggled through the billows. As he walked, he could see places where a few brave neighborhood kids had made angels in the drifts or tried to roll a snowman, but none had lasted very long. When Tomas finally reached the O'Toole's single-story home, he found not a soul out front and no footprints anywhere. It made sense enough. It was Saturday morning, and Carol was definitely the cartoon-watching type. He whistled through the white driveway and was surprised that Bart O'Toole, with the way he worked, hadn't already been out to shovel a path. Tomas shuffled up the porch steps and peeked through the little door window. His vision blurred and his breath stopped cold when he saw, on the white wall of the hallway, just below a plastic light switch, a smeared handprint of blood. The front door was locked, but within seconds Tomas had run around the house and found the back door slightly open, with a dusting of snow blown across the kitchen floor. He crossed the kitchen and lunged through the hallway and found Carol and Bart and Dottie O'Toole dog-piled on the soggy carpet just inside the master bedroom doorway. To say he'd never seen so much blood in all his life would imply that he'd seen blood before, when he hadn't, not blood in the way that this was blood. A gag creaked out of him. The family looked inside out, pulverized. He pulled on their shoulders and flopped their limbs, searching in a panic for his daughter. He would do anything if... Lydia wasn't among them, and soon he stood in the kitchen spitting into the sink and tried not to look at the hammer, sticky red, poking up from the disposal like a broken bone. Without thinking,
He grabbed a damp rag folded on the sink side and wiped his lips and put it back. He wanted to scream for Lydia, but remembered that no footprints marked the outside snow, meaning no one had left recently, meaning whoever did this could still be in the house. So he gripped the hammer and stormed through the hall and into the rooms, leaping over the body pile. There was urine in the toilet, and a small squat of floating tissue just like Lydia's when she forgot to flush at home. He felt sick, and charged through the kitchen, and even lunged down the steps to the unfinished basement, crashing doors, spinning circles, and finally screaming, "Lydia!" No one answered. Back in the kitchen, he punched 911 and noticed a few stalks of red hair sprouting from the V of the hammer's claw. The dispatcher on the phone enraged him with her patronizing calm, and he was just about to throw the hammer through the window when he saw his own bloody boot prints spread over the floor like steps for some diabolical dance. He noticed the drips here and there, the drizzles, the smears. He paused. The dispatcher said he had 10 minutes max before the cops arrived, and to "Sir, please make sure you're safe." But with the snow piled in the streets the way it was, Tomas thought 20 minutes would be optimistic. He slammed down the phone even as the dispatcher was still speaking and held his hand over his mouth and looked down the length of the hallway where Dottie's arm flopped out from the pile, stiff and darkening, her hand bent into a claw. He quickly turned back to the kitchen and didn't know why, but opened the refrigerator and saw hot dog casserole and sticky ketchup and crusty buttermilk, and God help him, he thought, these were the fragments of Lydia's last meal. Then, from the sink, came a sound. He spun on his heel with the fridge door open and its jars and bottles rattled like church bells. He shushed them with his fingers. The sound of a bird, the faintest of whimpers. Bent in half, nose as close to the floor as he could get without falling over, he followed the whimpers like they were fairy tale breadcrumbs until they stopped beneath the sink, and just as he extended his arm to rip open the cabinet door opened on its own. He raised the hammer instinctively, but then Lydia climbed out, her shirt front soggy from all night sucking, her face and forehead masked with blood, and she scampered right up his chest and into a desperate hug. Chapter 9. Lydia scratched the faint scar on her forehead as she walked, head down, toward the children's section of Bright Ideas. Her beaten leather satchel was slung over her shoulder, and Joey's copy of A Universal History of the Destruction of Books was tucked under her arm. Today was Lydia's day off, but she arrived at the store 20 minutes before it opened. She loved roaming the stacks when it was early and empty like this, feeling the quiet, hopeful promise of all those waiting books. But today she stayed on task. Joey. When Lydia arrived in Kids, her comrade Wilma, a sharp-tongued and warm-hearted 80-year-old, was standing in the center of the picture book alcove, wearing her usual navy slacks, crocheted turtleneck, and pearlescent glasses. The alcove was still ripped apart from last night's cocktail crowd, and Wilma stood at its center, holding a 2-foot-tall board book with googly eyes, furry arms, lights, buzzers, bells, and rubber tentacles that bounced toward her shoes like slinkies. Wilma? In what world is this a book? She said, and her mouth was puckered as if she had cat hair on her tongue. How are you supposed to read this to a child? I think it reads itself, Lydia said. There goes humanity, Wilma said. Then she turned to a shelf of stuffed animals and slapped a sock monkey off his perch, just because. Do you know anything about this? She said, handing Wilma the copy of A Universal History of the Destruction of Books, but pointing to the label on the back. Wilma lifted her glasses and squinted at the label, then turned the book over and looked at the cover. It's obviously been mislabeled, she said. Everything okay? Before becoming a bookseller, Wilma had spent decades working as a grade school librarian, and something in the way she lowered her voice and turned her head made Lydia feel like a wounded child. I don't know, to be honest, Lydia said. Wilma nodded and led Lydia by the forearm into the quadrant of parenting books,
then slid out a book with a photograph of a disheveled bed on its cover. In serious font, it read, The Bedwetter's Almanac, Folklore, Wives' Tales, and Cures from Around the Globe. It was, indeed, missing its label, but none of its pages had been cut up and it was in perfect condition. In fact, other than its font being slightly larger than usual, nothing seemed to stand out about it at all.
"Is that boyfriend of yours a bedwetter?" Wilma said, gesturing to the book.
"Only when he's drunk." Wilma smiled, then grew serious.
"This is about Joey, isn't it?"
Lydia nodded, and Wilma gently guided her to the rocking chair near the pop-up books, Joey's favorite seat.
"I didn't like that Joey kid at first," Wilma said,
stroking her papery fingers over the nearby shelf of fairy tales.
"Coming down here and hogging the rocking chair while moms nursed their babies standing up. I thought he was clueless, maybe a bit sinister. I can't tell you how many times I came through here and caught him sitting in that very seat, tilting back and forth, staring at little kids over the top of his book. Creepy, right?"
"I guess," Lydia said. "Joey wasn't really the creepy type, though."
"But then I realized something," Wilma continued, hushing Lydia with the slightest lifted finger. "You know what you see when you're sitting in that chair? Everything. At least, everything in the kids' section. And you know when Joey sat there the most? On Saturday mornings. You know what this place is like on Saturday morning. A zoo. The busiest time of the week."
Wilma pointed to the pair of books in Lydia's lap.
"The time he was least likely to get any reading done."
"I don't get it."
"He wasn't here to watch the kids, Lydia, and he wasn't here to read. He was here to watch the families. For whatever reason, he liked watching the moms and dads and kids interacting. It's a beautiful thing to behold, really. It's enough to keep you young. Most people don't even see it until they themselves are prunes like me."
"That sounds like Joey."
"Once I realized that," Wilma said, "I felt bad for misjudging him. That kid had a giant hole in his heart, and he sat right there to try to fill it."
Lydia gulped, and when she stood from the chair, it rocked forward and bumped the back of her knees. "You haven't seen Lyle, have you?" she asked.
"Now that you mention it," Wilma said, "I haven't. Not since Joey's death."
"Let me know if he shows up, will you?" Lydia said, then lifted the bedwetting book. "And thanks for this. I'll bring it back in a few days."
"Take your time," Wilma said, walking away. "It's not our most popular title."
Lydia did take her time, standing in the parenting alcove and studying the two books side by side, trying to figure out why Joey had labeled the one with the other. As far as she could tell, they had nothing in common except that, at some point, they'd both been in Joey's hands. She shuddered and gave up. When she left the kids' section, both books tucked under her arm, Wilma was kneeling on a pillow, reading a picture book to herself, dabbing a Kleenex against her nose. "That kid had a giant hole in his heart," she'd said. "And if anyone could measure its depths, could drop a pebble into its well and listen for the plunk, it was Wilma." On the pedestrian mall a few blocks up from Bright Ideas, Lydia sat alone on a sidewalk bench. The morning was cold but sunny, carved with the sharpened shadows of 16th Street. She set her coffee and the two books on the bench next to her and retrieved a small box of raisins from her jacket pocket. As delicate as a shorebird, she stuck her fingers into the tiny box, moved each raisin to her lips, and chewed. As she nibbled, she studied the red box until the sounds of passing traffic disappeared. The woman printed on the raisin box was as she'd always been, young and glowing, wearing a red bonnet and holding her bounty of grapes against a giant yellow sun. Picking, chewing, swallowing, Lydia was a child again. Raisins! How had she forgotten about raisins? The way the smallest seeds stuck in her teeth, the way she felt when her fingers were little and... A shadow crossed her eyelids. A delivery truck hummed past. A man stood next to the bench.
"Is it really you?"
the man said. The sun was bright behind him, and Lydia had a hard time seeing his face. "Excuse me?"
"You are Lydia, right? Of course you are. My God. Hello."
He took a step toward her, and Lydia nearly flinched. She thought for a second he had something in his hand, but it turned out it was just his hand. "Who do you think you are?" she said, but she still had raisins in her mouth, and as usual, she sounded more apologetic than pissed.
"This must seem strange," he said, stepping back. "Showing up like this? No warning?"
Lydia's eyes were adjusting to his silhouette in the sunlight, and his features soon were clear. His skin was rich and dark, his black hair clean and mussed, and the brown of his eyes was so brown, the white so white, that she felt as if she were looking at a photographic negative. He wore a suede sport jacket, rough blue jeans, embroidered belt. He was slightly chubby, but stood sturdy, confident.
Irritating. "Lydia? You really don't recognize me? Little Flower?"
Now she did recognize him. "Oh my God," she said, and her breath gave a little jump when she thought about this man as a boy wearing a buckled jumpsuit and gazing at her with adoration. "Raj?" He opened his arms, and Lydia, after a quailing pause, stood into a hug.
"Look at us," he said. "Both alive."
Lydia took a step back and grabbed the nape of her neck. Her impulse was to sprint down the sidewalk as fast as her awkward feet would carry her. But then, somewhere inside, she felt a small bright glimmer, and she was greeted with a simple image of the two of them as children, sitting on the carpet in her father's library, leaning back to back, encircled by books. She almost smiled. "I just can't believe you're here, Raj, because it's been like..."
"Like 20 years.
"Wow, 20. Sheesh." She nodded into the cold, then lifted her coffee and moved her books into her lap. "So, sit with me." "Yeah, sit already." Both sat on the slatted bench. A pigeon flapped past in the street.
"I saw your picture in the newspaper," Raj said.
"You're not the only one," she said. "You do realize that was like 2 weeks ago."
"It took me that long to gather the nerve to come down here, to be honest."
He nodded in the direction of the bookstore a few blocks west.
"I wasn't expecting to find you on the way."
"I sit out here a lot."
"Lucky for me," he said.
His teeth still gleamed, just as they had when they were kids, and his hair was still a shaggy mess, and his skin still glowed.
"I wasn't even sure you wanted to see me again. Otherwise, you would have..."
"Otherwise, I would have looked you up when I moved back to town?" "It really wasn't intentional, Raj."
"You don't have to explain, Lydia. It doesn't get more loaded than us."
"No," she said, smiling. "It doesn't."
"We're carrying some serious baggage," he said. "Especially you," he added, then gently closed his eyes. "Sorry, that was probably the wrong thing to say."
"Only because it's true," she said, and lightly slugged his arm.
"I guess I'll see you in another 20 years.
Both of them were smiling now, unable not to. Lydia surprised herself by grabbing Raj's hand. She didn't say anything, and he didn't either, but after a minute, Raj let go and slid over to his half of the bench.
"So, how long have you been back?"
"In Denver? Gosh, like 6 years?"
"And here all this time I thought you were hiding in the mountains," he said. "Address unknown."
"For a long time I was."
"One day there was a for sale sign on your lawn, and that was it for my pal Lydia."
"The plan was to stay in touch," she said. "But then, you know."
"I know."
"I tried."
"I know."
And Lydia was being truthful. When she and her father had fled Denver in the middle of her fourth grade year for the small town of Rio Vista, Colorado,
She'd done her best to write letters to Raj, even if it simply meant letting him know she was alive and safe and missing his friendship. She'd spent more time decorating the letter's margins with flowers and forest creatures than she had on the sullen details of her days. Her father always read and redacted her letters carefully before driving to distant towns, Salida, Gunnison, Leadville, and nailing them without a return address. Since no one could know where they'd ended up settling, Raj never had the option of writing her back. Eventually, predictably, her letters had stopped. Lydia looked down at the sidewalk's gray and pink granite pavers, arranged to resemble the scales of a diamondback slithering through downtown. It was quiet between them. She reached across the bench and gave his wrist a little shake. "It's good to see you again," she said. "I mean it."
"Sorry about the circumstances," he said, "but I'm dying to know what's up with your name." The caption in the paper gave the Lydia part. "But Lydia Smith? What happened to Gladwell? You got married? Let me see those hands again. I don't see a ring."
"My dad changed our name back when we moved. We were supposed to be anonymous."
"So you're not married?"
She said. "No."
"I'm kind of surprised by that," he said,
then crossed his legs and tugged a frayed thread from the cuff of his jeans. "But involved?" she said, though it sounded as if it were a question. Raj shifted on the bench.
"They never caught him, did they?" he said.
Lydia stared at the argyled mannequins and rainbow kites displayed in the window across the way, and the young woman with a shaved head shouldering her acoustic guitar down the sidewalk. "Raj," she said, "I'd rather not go there."
"It's old news anyway."
She thought she should say something more, but a sudden lump filled her throat, and up and down her spine she could feel the familiar fronds of discomfort that accompanied most reminders of her childhood. She thought about asking him not to mention her past to anyone, but one look into his eyes, a soft, dark brown like sea glass, and as kind and wary as ever, and she knew her past would always be safe with Raj. She took a deep breath. "And you, Raj? What are you doing with yourself?" He shrugged, then pointed loosely in the direction of Union Station.
"I live above a bar, just over there, where that construction is happening. And I'm a cashier at a copy shop. But I guess I'm trying to be a graphic designer."
He opened his wallet and pulled out a card and handed it to her.
"I'm calling it my own company," he said. "But really, it's just whatever jobs I call from the copy counter."
Lydia studied the card.
"And what about your dad?" Raj added. "Is he
crazy?" she said.
"Oh, yes." "They only get nuttier with age, don't they?" "He has, that's for sure." "Mine too," Raj said. "Both of them." "So, tell me."
"We aren't speaking," she said. "My dad and I guess we're, what's the word,
over?" "Really? Because your dad was so..."
"I'm sorry," she said. "I've just realized." She stood spontaneously and gathered her coffee, then lifted the pair of Joey's books into the air as if they signified some kind of serious business. "I'm in the middle of something here. Work." Raj stood too and stuck his hands in his pockets, and for a moment he looked boyish again, brooding and smart and, in the right light, easily as handsome as David. "Can we do this another time, though?" she added.
"Of course," he said. "I see you drink coffee. We could do that together."
"Yeah," she said. "Let's do that. Soon." When she was a good 50 feet down the block, she heard him yell,
"My number's on the card."
She spun around and gave him a high thumbs up, and a pair of passing women in bright ski parkas and bright lipstick looked at her as if she were drunk. Lydia hadn't planned on heading back to the bookstore any more than she'd planned on escaping from Raj, but now that she was walking in that direction, she felt an unexpected mix of clarity and unease. She needed to be done with Joey, she decided, and wash her hands of his death. She'd return the Bedwetter's Almanac to its empty slot on the parenting shelves,
and give serious thought to donating Joey's crate of butchered books to a thrift store. As she headed toward Bright Ideas, she could feel a certain stride entering her walk, and she swung her satchel back on her shoulder and slid Joey's books together, cupping them in her palm. The Bedwetter's Almanac, A Universal History of the Destruction of Books. Lydia spent so much time carrying books up and down the stairs of the store that she was pleased at how nicely this pair fit together. They were simply snug, easy to carry, no bumbling or sliding apart, almost like a pair of Lego bricks. In the middle of the sidewalk, Lydia stopped cold. A ponytailed man jogging with a stroller huffed and veered around her. Lydia mumbled an apology, but her focus was already on the books in her hand. She looked at the books, side by side, spine by spine, back to back. A Universal History of the Destruction of Books, The Bedwetter's Almanac. She pressed the books atop each other. They weren't just the same size, they were the exact same size. No lip, no overhang, no difference but the words. Okay, Joey. Words. Last words? Lost words? Words, words, words. I make the codices speak. There on the sidewalk, she opened A Universal History to its first cut-up page, page 128. Then she opened The Bedwetter's Almanac to its own page 128, which was wholly intact. It was an awkward process, folding back the cut-up book without stressing its spine. But when she slid them together and lined them up perfectly, page 128 on page 128, the little cut-out windows were now filled in by the words and letters of the book behind. A perfect fit. A key finding its lock. A message from the grave. UFO-UND-ME-GEN-LI-D-A-J. Chapter 10. Lydia's skills as a bookseller came mainly, she believed, from her ability to listen. A raging case of bibliophilia certainly helped, as did limited financial needs. But it was her capacity to be politely trapped by others that really sealed her professional fate. From bus stops to parties to the floors of the store, Lydia was the model of a good listener. A sounding board for one and all. Strangers and acquaintances and the occasional friend unloaded on her by the hour. Add booze and it was every 5 minutes. And Lydia's main conversational contributions consisted of, yeah, or hmm, or great, or geez, or ouch, or yikes, or wow. The unloading voice this time belonged to a middle-aged book frog named Pedro, a tender man with red suspenders and white sneakers who'd cornered Lydia 20 minutes ago next to the potted ficus in genre fiction. Pedro was unable to speak without intense fidgeting, so throughout his entire riff he pruned the tree by hand, dropping one leaf at a time to the wood floor, as if to punctuate his points. He was talking about his favorite sci-fi authors, explaining the worlds they'd created with enough detail for Lydia to formulate spaceship blueprints, and she politely listened. Yeah, she said, and hmm, and great, and geez, and ouch, and yikes, and wow. Appreciating not so much the worlds themselves, but the fact that Pedro had become so lost in their trance that he was unable to stop himself from sharing them. All the while, Lydia nodded along, admiring his penchant for details and finding it sweet that he wasn't hitting on her, and probably, more than anything, feeling grateful to be focusing on something besides the message she'd discovered yesterday in Joey's books. "You found me again, Lydia." And the subsequent pair of messages she'd managed to decode before work this morning as well. Joey's words had scared the bejesus out of her, so Pedro's riff was a calming distraction. Just as she was settling in to hear about another sci-fi system, she peered across the bookstore floor and spotted Lyle dropping down the stairs, sipping from a paper cup of tea. "Hold that thought," she said to Pedro. "Lyle!" By the time Lydia caught up with him, Lyle was already paging through the Sunday Times at a tilty table in the coffee shop. She plunged into the wooden chair across from him. Lyle pressed his glasses to the bridge of his nose.
"Lydia," he said calmly with an affected Brahmin accent.
"Lydia,
join me."